I'm the doctor, by the way.
You're listening to Pieces of Eighth, the Doctor Who podcast that takes no prisoners.
Well, apart from ourselves when we're mocking one another, but other than that, we don't. Anyway, we're carrying on in our trip through those sections of the Doctor Who universe that feature the incarnation of the Time Lord, as played by Paul McGann. I am not Paul McGann, I'm Kenny Smith.
And I am not Grace Holloway, I am Rebecca Chapman. You join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen, in books, novellas, full cast audio, short stories, comics, animations, talking books, or anything else we can lie our eyes, ears, and hands upon. Ooh, yep. That was one breath.
That was very impressive. Very impressive breath there. And today we're going to be going back in time by 10 years to mark a story that features the Eighth Doctor from 2013, and it isn't Night of the Doctor. I know, how unusual.
I know. You feel like you go, 50 years. Night of the Doctor, obviously. It has to be. But no, today we are looking at the 8th episode of Prisons of Time, which was a 12-issue comic book miniseries produced by IDW to celebrate Doctor Who's 50th anniversary. Released monthly throughout 2013, each of the first 11 parts featured a different Doctor, which led up to the final multi-Doctor issue in December.
And today we're looking at The Body Politic, which was released on the 28th of August 2013. Becca, could you tell us what the IDW publicity had to say about this one?
Of course. Our year-long celebration of Doctor Who's 50th anniversary continues. The Eighth Doctor takes the spotlight in this issue of a 12-part epic adventure featuring all 11 incarnations of the Doctor. After helping him defeat the Master, the Doctor attempts to convince Grace Holloway to join him on his travels in this untold tale.
But it's now been told, so it's now a told tale. But not a told
Indeed.
Tale. It's excellent.
No.
Yep. Now, Becca, you're a big comics fan. Had you come across Roger Langridge's artwork before? Because he has got such a brilliant style.
I feel like I have, but never by name. Like, yeah. It's a very... I don't want to say unique, because then it sounds like it's bad, but it's very obviously his.
Yes, it's a wonderful style. I mean, I think Doctor Who Magazine...
Recognisable! It's a very recognisable style.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, I remember first seeing it in Doctor Who Magazine, I think it was when I first came across Roger's work, and I've seen it in so many places since then, and it's wonderful. So what did you think about this one, as you are, a bit of a comics fan?
I love it. I really like it. It's everything you want from a comic and everything you want from Doctor Who. It's got the monster of the week. It's got the Doctor going, oh, I can't possibly just do these things on a whim, and then going, actually, yes, I can.
Yeah, very much so. I think, I mean, early, the fact we get early doors, we get the Doctor meeting Grace again, just one trip, she says,
yeah,
and fist bumping, and then... Just, I love that sort of the trips to the alien worlds they go to with like the sort of like the tiger aliens, then alien space world with cars and hanging out the TARDIS, looking at floating cities. Just wonderful. And then Grace struggles to cope with it all.
I think, as we all would, although all of us would give, you know, our left arm to to be with the Doctor, we'd all struggle.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, were you surprised to see Grace? Because I know that I was.
I kind of felt like Grace was just a fantastic part of the movie, but that was as far as it was going to go, so it was nice.
Yeah, and I think you get, meeting the local villagers. I mean, that's, again, it's something that you mentioned in yesterday's episode, sort of like the typical Doctor Who stuff is sort of meeting sort of... almost like medieval villagers in a spacey world, and you're sitting down and enjoying dinner with them before the aliens arrive.
See, sitting down and enjoying dinner with aliens doesn't feel very doctory, but...
No, but having lunch with the villagers does. But yeah, what do you think of the design of them? Because they're such a fantastic sort of... You can imagine them being CGI'd, but definitely not done with masks with their tall, thin heads.
Oh, the overseers. I think we're talking about the villagers. That was a
No. Definitely the overseers.
Yes, no. I feel like it probably could be done with masks. Or at least a lot of prosthetics.
Yeah, yeah. Probably for fake head as well, given how tall they are. But, I mean, there's just great moments like Grace being taken away in the hover space car and the doctor giving chase. I mean, I love that. There's some fact that Grace sort of
Grace didn't get taken away. She stole the car.
Sorry, you're right. You're absolutely right. Yes. But and then she crashes it.
Better at taking off than landing.
That's very true. But yeah, I love the competition. And then the fact that they get away and they get locked in a broom cupboard.
Yes, that is fantastic. And goes to, it's a very poignant moment where the doctor realizes that he's probably the first people to have stood against the overseers and their entire kind of, I don't want to say reign, but.
Yeah. You could say the reign of terror.
Yeah, isn't that a Doctor Who episode in itself?
It is. Well done. Well spotted. Good heart and stuff. And the fact that they've been sort of, what they've been using the villagers for as well.
That's horrible. So. It was always going to be something like that. I kind of presumed that it was going to be like slavery, but
organ farming is not good. It's a bit of a trick. But no, and then of course we get to the end and there's this mysterious character. Do you know who it is?
I do not.
Would you like me to tell you who it is, or would you like it to be a surprise? Because you've only got obviously the McGann issue. It is Adam from The Long Game, and Dalek after he gets left behind.
Oh, no way!
Way?
That's amazing.
Yeah. But it's him, he's out for revenge, and it's a wonderful, wonderful comic book. Lots of different doctors and a different artist for every issue. And
I'm going to have to get the rest of the issues, aren't I?
Oh, I picked this up, I think it was for a couple of quid on eBay. I got the complete graphic novel version, the Titan reissue, and it's very, very good. It's, I picked up for a couple of quid and very well worth looking for. So, yeah.
I will have a look.
Fantastic. Now, I have spoken with the writers from across the pond. I got in touch with Scott and David Tipton, and I've spoken to them. So, would you like to hear from them?
I would, yes.
It'd be rather rude if we didn't.
It would, wouldn't it?
Hi, I'm David Tipton. I've written a number of Star Trek and Doctor Who books with my brother Scott Tipton, something we still kind of do on an ongoing basis. And Scott, what have you got to add to that?
Yeah, I would say besides a huge passel of Star Trek books, we've gotten to write two Doctor Who projects, the Star Trek Doctor Who crossover, Assimilation Squared, and the previous anniversary, because we're coming up on a new anniversary, for Doctor Who, of Prisoners of Time, which was so much fun to write.
I can imagine. So I take it, it'd be fair to say that growing up, you were fans of Doctor Who and probably caught it on PBS.
Yeah, I mean, Doctor Who didn't have quite the same sort of connection to people and availability in the US as it does in the UK, but it did run here on public television, on PBS. Mostly for years, I think it's fair to say most people in the US thought about the Doctor as the fourth Doctor, right, Scott?
Yeah, well, I mean, I only first saw it, even though it was on public TV, I still never kind of came across it. A friend of mine started giving me some VHS tapes in junior high school, but it was all Tom Baker. It was all
right, exactly. It was all the Tom. And I would say it's probably not unfair to say that most people in the U.S. didn't know much about the doctors at all.
I had no idea there was another doctor.
Yeah, exactly. And part of what was happening with the fourth doctor in the U.S. is that Star Trek in syndication and repeats on television was very, very popular in the US in the 70s. And to sort of, I'm not sure capitalize on that's the right word, but along with that, that's I think part of why the PBS picked up on Doctor Who, and that's about the right time for the Fourth Doctor. So yeah, that's why the Fourth Doctor became such a, he actually did get a fair amount of popularity in the US because PBS said, hey, we've got a science fiction show we can show too. We've got access to these Doctor Who episodes from the BBC. And so that's why the Tom Baker Doctor was for a long time, for a lot of people, what they thought of as Doctor Who programming in the US.
Yeah. The syndication boom of Star Trek all of a sudden created a market in which Doctor Who could actually become popular. And because the Fourth Doctor, Tom Baker, had that run for so long, there were lots of episodes they could show too, which also helped.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did your comic writing begin, Scott?
I had been writing some Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel books for IDW previously, just a few things here and there. And then IDW landed the Star Trek license. And then I got my attention. And I went to our editor-in-chief, Chris Ryle, and I said, look, I know you can't just give me the job. I've only done a few books, but just get me a meeting. I'll get myself the job. Just get me in the door. So I got a chance to pitch some books or some ideas to CBS, and they liked them. And when I started writing the first one, that's when I decided to bring in David, and I'd been writing a lot of comics. David had not. And I said, look, this is Star Trek. We both have the same ideas about what makes a good Star Trek story. Come in and write this one with me. And if you hate it, you never have to do it again. So we started working on this one, and he seemed to enjoy it, and we've been doing it ever since.
And you know, to be clear about what Scott says, you don't just get these. I mean, you really do have to go through a pitch process, and that's kind of what will lead up to talking about the Doctor Who part, is that, you know, convincing the licensors that you're going to do a good job with their material and tell stories that are aligned with what they want is key to the job.
Yeah, and, it's not just pitching the publisher, it's pitching the licensor.
Exactly. So there's two levels you have to work on. And then when you've got something like a crossover, then there are three levels or four really, because there's two publishers and two licensors. there is a lot there. And then, you know, as I've often mentioned before, sometimes when we're doing crossovers, we get notes on Doctor Who from CBS and notes on notes on Star Trek from the BBC. And so that's where, you know, when Scott talks about starting out, after you get past the starting out phase, then there's all of that work that goes into these kind of projects.
My goodness, that sounds very, very complex. Oh dear. So David, you were just suggesting about having to appeal and appease the different parties involved. So how did the commission to do Doctor Who Prisoners of Time come about?
Well, and Scott might have to correct me if I don't remember anymore, but we were kind of, Scott and I had just finished, I think, the Harlan Project, Scott?
No, we had just finished Star Trek Doctor Who.
I'm sorry, but did the Harlan Project come before Star Trek Doctor Who or after?
After.
Okay, so we just finished Star Trek Doctor Who, and that's what kind of led into, well, these guys can write Doctor Who. I mean,
to be completely honest, we kind of heard through the grapevine there was going to be a big Doctor Who anniversary book at IDW. Yeah. And we said, hey, over here, we just wrote a big, long, fancy Doctor Who Star Trek story. Give us a chance to pitch.
Right. And then also, this ties into what I was just talking about, that they're a lot more likely to be receptive to your pitch if you're someone who has shown in the past that you can handle licensed content well.
Yeah.
And that's where I think, and what was also going on at that exact same time is that we had just done Star Trek Doctor Who, and... What's that?
Which was a huge hit.
Which was a big hit. Yes. And also, this is right around that time when the Matt Smith era of Doctor Who went huge in the U.S. It was very, very popular in the U.S. I mean, and I don't think there's no accident there that in this case, in part, that was because there was no Star Trek on television.
Yeah, that played into it, I think.
That played into it.
not to downplay how good the Eccleston, Tennant, and Smith years were. Those were great stuff, but they had the field wide open.
And there was something about Matt Smith, and he was young in a way that maybe some doctors weren't, and he was different. I mean, and it really caught everybody's attention. And I think part of it was also the way those episodes were produced and written. It was sort of like just waiting for the U.S. audience. It was like, wow, what is this?
it was hip in a way Doctor Who had never been before.
Yes, it was. And when you tied that into the fact that this was a period where there had actually, I think, Scott, had the new Star Trek movie had come out.
Yeah.
But there was no Star Trek TV. And in fact, there were people thinking, where's the Star Trek TV? And there was a little bit of a kind of a gap there in really good any kind of science fiction television for a few years there.
I think Battlestar Galactica had just wrapped up.
Right.
Yes, there was much there. And you know, what happened was this, you know, Eccleston's Doctor Who came in and got everyone's attention. And then Tennant's came in, and since the Tennant stuff was kind of a romance in a way Doctor Who never was, all of a sudden American female fans really latched on to Doctor Who.
That's true.
You've got Smith, who had that crazy charisma and was funny and young, and it was kismet. Everything worked together.
Yeah.
When we were pitching for this, I mean, there were lots of good people really trying to get this book because everyone wanted to write the anniversary book and get the chance to play with everything. And so we really had to get in there and show them what we could do.
Yeah, this, if I think about difficult pitches that I've had, this is one of them. was hard. And, you know, Star Trek Doctor Who was hard too, but on that one, in some ways, we were established as Star Trek writers also, so it was a little bit easier for us there. We really had to work hard on this particular pitch.
I can imagine it would be a toughie keeping BBC happy to do something.
And then going into the end of this project, we knew we definitely wanted you know a big role for the Matt Smith Doctor because it was so popular at the time. But also, part of what I think we pitched was we want to introduce these older doctors to a U.S. audience that might not know them.
Right.
And that's how the way this book played out was each one of these is sort of you probably don't know about this doctor. You might not know about this particular doctor and the stories there, but we're going to tell you sort of a characteristic story of that doctor.
Right.
And then for each one of these, we had to go through and really do the research and not just, I'm going to tell a story with using this character, but sort of an example story in a way, but this is the kind of stories that go along with this doctor. Is that something, Scott?
No, that's exactly right. But what made it all the more tricky is we were doing two things. We wanted to give you an example story of this is what the third doctor's tales were like while you're still telling a larger story.
Yeah.
So we still had to link together in ways and create a larger mystery.
Yeah,
I do think that's kind of what got the BBC's attention is that it wasn't just a huge fan service thing where all the doctors were together all the time.
No, we did not want that.
it wasn't super timey wimey where we were playing with the nature of the universe. So, and I think we even said this in our pitch is that most of the American audience doesn't know doctors 1 through 8 at all.
Except for four.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great because it very much, you're capturing the feel of each era, and then the fact you've got different artists for each story as well. I think that gave it such a unique feel.
Yeah, and our editor at the time did a great job with pulling out some of these artists that were typical from the time.
Yeah,
that was
Denton.
Yeah, that was Denton. He did a great job with that. I mean,
our unbrother Denton Tipton, who was
no relation, just the same last name. And so, you know, Denton was going through and finding the right artist for each one of these. And then at the same time, Scott and I were trying to tell stories that would not only do, you know, what kind, what does they show their character, what do they show the time, but we went to the trouble of trying to fit them into a characteristic time period, like, you know, is it the third one, Scott? I've got Nixon showing up in there, and you're like, what do you do with Richard Nixon? And that's like, well, this is a 70s story, and we wanted to fit in an interesting kind of way, and that was a lot of work.
David surprised me with Nixon. That was not in our original plot. Usually when you write these things, we'll plot it out together, and then we'll divvy it in half, and I'll write one half, and he'll write one half, and then we'll come back, put it together, and do a polish. And I get the pages back for the second half of that issue. I was like, what is Nixon doing here? We didn't talk about this, but we're great. and also, to go back to the artists, for that one, you get someone like Mike Collins, who just kills it. He's great at that. You know, and we got John Ridgway, and we got Lee Sullivan, all these people who were like known for be writing there for drawing these Doctor stories, and they just did a wonderful job.
Yeah,
and I think in particular you get Roger Langridge, of course, doing chapter 8, The Body Politic, and just, I mean, it is such a fantastic story. It's just that the alien culture, just Roger giving the aliens their own life, just that unique look, using that amazing style that he has.
And, you know, I didn't know Roger's work from anything from Doctor Who. The only thing I'd seen him do, there is a brief period here where he was doing Muppet Show comics. Oh, and they were, I loved them.
That's right. And as soon as you said that, the style in my mind reminded me of those Muppet comics. Yes.
Yeah. And he captured it perfectly. So I mean, we were so happy to get those pages back.
I can imagine, because the thing that, I mean, I remember the first time I read it, I was struck by the fact that Grace Holloway's there, given that Grace had, I think she had appeared in one Doctor Who magazine comic strip, and that was it. Nobody else had ever touched the character. So I'd imagine that the terms of the license meant you could use everything and anything that you wanted.
Yeah, and even some stuff that we couldn't use, which we'll get back to. The thing to remember with the Eighth Doctor is that, I mean, this is before Paul McGann returned to the role in any sort of, either in audios or anything, I think. And so the only thing we had to work with was that one Fox TV movie for him. And so that meant, you know, if the point of the story was to kidnap all the companions, it had to be Grace Holloway. So that would kind of became our way into the story.
Yeah. So, and of course, then getting Frobisher in for the Sixth Doctor as well, an old Marvel favorite as well. That must have been great fun, going back, reading those old comics and getting the feel for Frobisher.
Yeah, the Frobisher thing was a little bit of a problem, right, Scott?
Yeah, a touch. It turns out the BBC doesn't really own Frobisher. No one told us that. No one told us under that.
Yeah, I mean, we knew going in that, well, you know, this Frobisher's only in the comics, but this is a comic, we got to bring him in, and then we did it, and then we found out that there was a little bit of an issue there, and that there might have to be a little bit more of a payment to the people who actually own Frobisher. And so, I mean, it all got worked out with the publisher and the BBC. But I mean, there was a brief moment where we were actually concerned we might have to change it to like a different bird or something, right? A puffin or something.
There was a version where he was a puffin with a different philosopher's name, because it was just,
So glad we didn't have to do that. I mean, it got easily sorted out, but I mean, there are a couple things like that where sometimes you think that everything within a license is secure, and then something's got another sub-license to it.
Yeah, especially because, you know, we've been toiling for years in the Star Trek mines, and CBS, Paramount owns everything. So there's not a single thing in any Star Trek that we can't use, because CBS has rights over all of it.
Yeah, the only exception to that is a couple things where, say, the person didn't sign an agreement before they passed
away. I think, there are only two likenesses that we can't use, because they passed away.
Yeah.
It was Harry Mudd and it's Cyrano Jones.
Yeah.
But for this, so we assumed, oh, Frobisher's in the comics. We got to pay tribute to the comics, and then it was right before print too that we found out that.
And also it was at a point where we kind of ended up thinking that or it turning out that Frobisher was sort of key to the story. And
that was sense. The other problem, is we had made Frobisher kind of key
I think convinced him that we've got to sort this out, because he'd end up being so key to the story that it was kind of hard to make him into a different bird at that point. I mean, it's like, you know, you can't call him like Snobisher or something and make him into like, you know, a totally different kind of bird.
No, it definitely helped that he was our secret weapon in the last issue.
Thank goodness for that. So just going back to the Eighth Doctor again, that must have been, you know, quite good fun, just watching the TV movie and trying to extrapolate as much character from that as you could for both the Doctor and Grace. And I love the fact that, you know, Grace is like the reluctant traveller, given the way that she turned down the chance to carry on travelling at the end of the movie. So I think that was quite a sort of nice character note that you picked up on.
Yeah, it was important to me that we stayed true, because that was all we had of her and all we had of the Eighth Doctor. So if we suddenly make her completely turn on a dime, that's not fair to the source material. And, you know, the most important thing for us is always that, whether it's Star Trek or Doctor Who, you could shoot this like an episode and it would feel right.
Yeah, and I think in that case, we talked about it, and we did that intensely so, because we were trying to... In each of these, and especially I think in that one, we wanted the companions to be also very much in line with what you would think about them for that particular iteration of Doctor Who. and I think that was one of the key things we wanted to do there. It's like, okay, does this give the reader a good idea of what this Doctor's story is like? And that's what we did. And, you know, that TV movie was even pretty largely inaccessible in the U.S. for a while, if I remember.
I mean, I had seen it and you hadn't, and we had to get you a bootleg copy.
We had to get me a DVD because I hadn't seen it. And that wasn't easy, as I recall.
Yeah, no, they hadn't put it out yet for a legit copy. So I think I found it at a local convention.
That's right. Yeah, no, I mean, and, you know, this is far before there were things like streaming. And also, and on top of that, there are always issues with sort of back and forth between BBC and the US as far as rights go. So things that you might easily get access to over there, you can't easily get here, and vice versa. And so, yeah, we had to get me a version of it to watch, because I hadn't seen it.
That's amazing. I suppose you must take great joy in doing things like world building and creating races like the Overseers, and just having a bit of fun with it, because it's definitely a fun story, this one. I think it's probably the lightest in tone, and I think that's where Roger's artwork suits it as well.
Yeah. I think we did know that Langridge was drawing it when we started. So we did kind of like tailor it to him. We always try and know beforehand who we're getting, so that we can play the story to their strengths.
Yeah, it's always interesting when I go back and look at something years later, which I did for this one, and you're right, I remember thinking, oh, this was actually lighter in tone than I remembered it. It was, and part of that connected in with the art as well, so yeah.
Brilliant. And of course, the wonderful thing is that, of course, you had 11 Doctors, 11 months, and then of course the 12th month, where you can bring everyone together. That must have been quite a challenge, just trying to give everyone their own little bit of the action.
Yeah, that was tough, because you want to give everybody moments, but it's still going to make sense. I mean, William Hartnell's not going to be down there grappling with the Autons, but you still got to keep him involved in the story and give him a moment. And keep the spotlight on everybody. And we had two villains, because we had the Master, and we had our lost companion, and our secret weapon of Frobisher playing in there. And I remember not knowing who the artist was going to be. It's like, oh, I'm so sorry, dude. We give you nothing but mob scenes for 22
minutes. Right. Yeah, that you're right. And you know, this is sort of a behind the scenes kind of thing, but when you give your artist the task of having to draw panels with so many characters in them, you feel so bad for them.
I felt so guilty. That's what we've been leading up to, and also that's what the BBC wanted. No,
was it till you mentioned that I remembered that, and I thought, oh my, these poor artists, what are they going to do with these pages here? Yeah, and these panels with all these different characters, and because that was how the story was all built from the beginning, it had to pay off in that way at the end. But you always feel bad.
Yeah.
The only thing that complicated it a bit, and this is something we ran into a couple of times over the course, is that at the same time we were doing this, the BBC was filming their anniversary special, the one with the Tennant Smith team up. So occasionally we'd want to do things, and we'd just get a note back from the BBC saying no. And we knew that meant they were doing something like it. And so, yeah. Like in that final issue, when all the doctors arrive, we wanted to have all the TARDISes lined up side by side appear at once, and they told us no. But now, looking back, because there's that scene at the end of the special with the three TARDISes lined up, and they wanted to save that for themselves. So that's what we kept there. Well, how about like if they come in like a kaleidoscope where we see shards of all the TARDISes? And BBC's like, yeah, that sounds great. Do that.
Yeah. And we had like two or three times during the run where that happened. And the first time we were like, why would they not want to do that? And then we kind of figured out that, oh, we're actually treading a little bit too close to what they happen to be doing in their upcoming special. And so then once we knew that, it made it a little easier on us, because they didn't even want to tell us,
they
didn't want to tell us too much, which you have to do. I mean, you've got to keep operational security in these projects. So
do you remember what it was? The first time?
Well, I don't remember what the first one was.
It was the Zygon.
Okay.
We wanted to use the Zygon in the...
Oh, that's right. That's right.
In the Peter Davison story.
That's right.
No, not Davison. In the Colin Baker story, we wanted to use a Zygon. And they're like, nope.
I love the Zygon. And then, yeah. And then when it happened once or twice more, we realized, oh, I bet these are part of what we're doing. And then when we saw it, they go, yeah, that's exactly what was happening. I mean, it's interesting how the people who are reviewing this content, they know what's coming. And so, and it in part, that's their job to say, oh, you don't want to replicate it in a comic book that might come out earlier. So, it's great they do their job as well. That they do a great job of doing that. I mean, it's not easy. I mean, we come across it with Star Trek sometimes as well. And yeah, you're right, Scott. That's what the other one was. And the first time we thought, oh, that's kind of weird.
Considering how much they were doing with their special and how much we were doing with this and how many parts we were playing with, it's amazing it didn't happen more often, honestly. Mm-hmm.
The thing that I particularly enjoyed was the fact that there's absolutely no idea who this villainous figure is. I'm thinking, is it somebody new? Is it a new creation? And then, of course, spoiler alert, people, it's Adam from The Long Game. And just think, yeah, that is, it makes sense because he's got that twisted, I never got my chance feeling. That must have been really good fun, sort of coming up with that idea and keeping it hidden until the very end.
That was all Scott's idea.
Well, because I love that episode, but I was terrified that either it was going to leak out or that the BBC was going to use him somewhere. I think we revealed it in the pitch, obviously. So it was approved in advance.
Yes, we did. Sometimes we don't reveal everything in the initial pitch, but in this case, since everything had hammered down, we did.
Yeah. But I mean, in terms of the comic, we don't reveal it until the Eccleston issue, whenever Rose recognizes him. So that's a long run, and I was just terrified that somebody was going to figure it out beforehand, and nobody did, which was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's the fact, adding something to an established character and be able to do something new with him, that must have been good fun for you as well.
Oh yeah, no, it was. I was so happy, and also it was important to me to redeem that character a bit. If I'm going to make him the villain, because Doctor Who, especially the Tennant run, is so much about forgiveness, and he had to have that moment where he'd be forgiven. And I thought the artist did a great job of bringing that to life. One of my favorite things, though, was running into the actor who plays him at Gallifrey One, maybe like 3 or 4 years after this came out. And I was in the green room, and he's in there just sitting on the couch eating a bagel. And I come up and introduce myself, and I go, there's the big anniversary series that just came out that we wrote that's got all the doctors, and it's got a massive new villain who's behind the whole thing, and it's you. He's like, what? And so I gave him the book, and he was like, "This is amazing. Why doesn't anybody tell me this stuff?" And like a couple hours later, I came back in to get lunch, and there he is on the couch just reading the book. he was really happy with it.
That's brilliant. I mean, it must have been such a pleasure for you, you know, given the reaction that the series got. It went down really, really well, and I remember reading lots of positive reviews and seeing it on social media as well. And you know, for all the, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears that you put into it, and the stress with Frobisher, it must have been a real relief for you to see that the fans appreciated it and got what you were doing.
Well, I mean, as it turned out, I can only speak for myself, but this is kind of still my favorite thing we've ever done, just because it was so big and ambitious, but also so flexible. We got to tell so many different kinds of stories, the kind of stories we don't get to do with Star Trek.
Yeah, it's still pretty much one of my favorites too. I mean, there was a whole lot of, in Star Trek, sometimes the weight of all of the previous episodes and movies kind of weighs you down a bit. And I was afraid that might be the case in this project, because there's a lot of Doctor Who. But in a way, the way the story got set up, we didn't seem to have that weight. And we got to tell a lot of creative stories, I think, that still were true to these doctors. And it was generally a lot of fun. I mean, usually when Scott and I write projects, in a given book, one of us will do one half, one of us do the other half, and then we coordinate. And in this project, that kind of traded off a little bit more. And there are more of these where one of us kind of did the guiding for the whole story, for the whole issue, and then we sort of switch off. Like the first six of these are more me. The last six of these are more Scott for the most part.
Yeah. And
some of that was also because Scott was more tied up with work than I was, with his regular job, than I was for the first half. And then I think I was more tied up in the second half. But it did pan out that way. And for some reason, it just ended up really a lot of fun in that kind of way. If it's not my favorite, it's very close to the top, but in a lot of ways, it might have been the most fun to write, and I don't know why that'd be different.
I think because every Doctor's iteration is so different from the others that every issue we would tackle, we'd have to start from scratch.
Yeah.
so there'd be a lot of research for each issue, but it also meant that every new issue was a different feel to it, so it was very fresh all the time. And also in terms of your note that the latter half is more mine, that's also because I was so more invested in the Eccleston, Tennant, and Smith series, and also because the Eccleston and Tennant ones were drawn by David Messina and Elena Casagrande, who we brought in, as opposed to, because there hadn't really been a huge amount of comics drawn for those doctors. So we got to use our own artists that we'd worked with extensively on Star Trek and on Angel. And on those two, working with David and Elena for us is a dream, because we worked together so long that, you know, they can anticipate what we're doing. And there's just kind of a visual shorthand with them that makes it so much more fun.
Of course, the book has been released in a compilation form in the US only from IDW that we didn't get over here on this side of the Atlantic. And you must have been delighted when Titan gave it a new lease of life in this format.
Yes.
I was so happy to see that, because again, it had never been in the UK for one thing. And so that meant that the audience that really was intended for finally got a chance to read it. And you always want your books out there in the world circulating and finding new readers, especially something that we were as fond of as this.
Yeah, the big IDW hardback collection is hard to get a hold of these days, and also even if it's not hard to get a hold of, it was expensive from the start. I think it's kind of more expensive now to find a used copy of it. So it was nice that Titan version came up. We were both happy about that.
Fantastic. David and Scott, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for your time on this. Well, what for you is a bright and sunny morning, and for me, it's a rainy 5 p.m. in Glasgow.
So, I can see it out the window.
Yeah, it's not the best. So thank you very much, gents. It's been a real joy. Thank you.
Thank you very much to David and Scott for that. Of course, a comic strip needs an artist to bring it to life, and Roger Langridge's unique larger-than-life art gives us the story of the body politic. So let's hear from him now.
Hi, I'm Roger Langridge. I'm the artist of Doctor Who Prisoners in Time Chapter 8, which featured the Eighth Doctor.
Is it fair to say you're a Doctor Who fan?
I watched a bit of Doctor Who when I was a kid. I think my first episode was Spearhead from Space, the first Pertwee one. And I sort of followed through partway through Tom Baker years and drifted off at that point. I was never like a really sort of major fan. What sort of turned me into a fan, as much as I am a fan, is working on the strip, to be honest. It was having Scott Gray's Eighth Doctor stories pass by my eyes every month, and I got really involved with those. And so when the relaunch of the show happened with Christopher Eccleston and Russell T Davies, I was very up for that, mainly because I'd become a fan of the character through the strip.
It's a rather interesting way that people become fans in so many different ways. So maybe tell us a wee bit about your background as an artist. When did you first discover that this might actually be something that you could turn from a hobby and an interest into a career?
It's not so much that I saw an opportunity to turn it into a career. It's that I never seriously considered anything else. I decided when I was very, very young, like maybe 7 years old, that I wanted to be a cartoonist. And didn't really have a plan B. I got a university degree because my parents insisted that I should have something to fall back on, but I've never used it. As soon as I could, I moved to the UK because the UK had a comic industry and New Zealand didn't. And because I'd done lots of sort of student work and stuff in zines and whatnot in New Zealand, I had already done by the time I arrived in the UK. So I just sort of schlepped around various people's offices. Because it was, you know, pre-internet days, you still had to show your portfolio to people in person. So I used to do that, and I got work doing stuff for Deadline and then for the Judge Dredd magazine. And I had some stuff published by Fantagraphics before I left New Zealand, so that helped as well. It was like a foot in the door. I had a published credential behind me. And never looked back, really. It hasn't always been full-time comics. I've sometimes had to do illustration work and things to make ends meet, but I've been writing and drawing ever since for a living.
What was your degree in, out of interest?
Oh, I did a BA, English mainly. A little bit of psychology, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, so when did the first interest come in terms of doing the Prisoners of Time strip?
Well, that was the 50th anniversary, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think so. It was around the... I don't remember. I guess I'm trying to remember the sequence of events. I think IDW approached me quite a few months before the book was due to come out, asking me if I would be available when it happened. There was a lot of approvals going on because it was quite a complicated event to coordinate, and they had to make sure that the artists were available, and it had to be in a timely fashion. So they were asking people quite a long way in advance with whether they'd be available. And I said I'd be up for it, expecting to get a script maybe a couple of months in advance. When I finally got it, it was like 2 weeks before the deadline, so it was a bit of a scramble to actually finish it on time. And you can probably see that from looking at the finished comic. The backgrounds are a bit sparse and the likenesses aren't quite there, but it was that or not finish it in time, so that's kind of how it happened.
Blimey.
Given the conditions, I thought it came out okay.
I would never have known, so... There you go. You've done well. You filmed this guy.
Oh, you got away with it.
Yeah. I suppose that by this point you'd done some stuff for DWM, so you had an idea of how to do your interpretation of McGann.
Yeah. It had been a few years. There'd been quite a few years break between doing McGann in DWM, which is when he was the official Doctor, and doing this one because he was a few Doctors back by that point. So I had to sort of look at how I'd done it back then and try and... I mean, it's almost a caricature of my own caricature in some places. It's just, you know, I figured out how to get a likeness that I didn't hate, and I had to remember how I did it and try and remember the sort of tricks I resorted to make it work on the page, because there's, you know, you can do a lot of photo reference for these sorts of characters that are based on real actors, and there's a danger of becoming quite stiff and lifeless on the page. So I tend to lean into the character side a bit more. That suits my style anyway, and it makes the characters come to life a bit more on the page. But it does mean that if the likeness slips a bit, it's much harder to get it back. So I was struggling with that quite a bit with the IDW. As I say, I think I sort of got away with it. the fact that he wears a distinctive costume and he's got the distinctive hair and everything does help.
Of course, you got the very rare opportunity to do a cartoon version of Grace Holloway, who I think was a bit of a surprise, given that most people thought she was out of bounds due to rights. And lo and behold, there we go.
I have no idea what the rights situation was. She was in the script, and I was expected to come up with a likeness for her. So that's, I think her likeness is actually probably better than my McGann likeness in that strip, because I was working directly from photographs for that and trying to sort of come up with an interpretation fresh from that, rather than having the intermediary step of having drawn him before and then trying to redraw him as I did with McGann. So there was sort of one less generation removed from the original actor's likeness. I'm relatively pleased with how it came out, considering the time constraints. Yeah. But yeah, I have no idea what the right situation was at all. I wasn't privy to any of that. So I just hope they cleared it, you know.
Yes, absolutely. And you're not legally liable for it. You just did what you were told.
Oh, yeah. Just following orders. I don't know if that excuse has ever worked. But
I think in this case it does, and you're indemnified. But the thing that really struck me was that the fact you got, you know, on the opening pages, this, you know, during the Doctor and Grace go on their travels, you get a good chance sort of like to flex your muscles with all these different settings.
Yeah, that was in the script. I think they were sort of very loosely described, but I think the detail was left up to me from memory. And yeah, speed being of the essence, I was also trying to think of how I could do these things in a way that was going to be quite easy to pull off. So, you know, the angles are quite front on, and I'm not doing anything too tricksy with the perspective or anything. But given that it's supposed to be a whole lot of sort of vignettes, you didn't want too much detail anyway. It'd be too much to take in. So that sort of worked all right. But yeah, making up mad stuff is quite a bit easier than trying to draw actual locations. You don't have to really worry about whether the laws of physics apply or anything like that. So that can be fun.
Yeah, I mean, I particularly enjoyed it. Once you get the adventure settles in the alien world, and you've got the chance to sort of, we've got like the local villagers, and then we've got the aliens coming in and their amazing, fantastic space cars and space cities. And I suppose it's that sort of capturing that sort of Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon sort of 1930s world, and just having great fun with it.
That's kind of my, not that I have a huge sort of science fiction background, but the science fiction I like tends to be that sort of retro stuff. Yeah, like you say, Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, that sort of old newspaper strip style, and, you know, EC Comics, that sort of thing. It's very much my go-to when I'm trying to do sort of science fiction vehicles and technology and things.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you got to, you obviously have you get the chance to invent some aliens as well, which I would imagine for an artist is always good fun.
Yeah, it had to be something I could do quickly and easily. So, you know, not too many tentacles or things. It was you know, distinctive heads and big capes covering most of the body. That's the way I worked around it.
Yeah, because I like the angular faces. To me, there was something, you know, again, fitting in with that sort of retro look, that sort of Star Wars sort of battle droid kind of angular face kind of look to them. And obviously they were designed with a 1930s vibe in mind as well.
Yeah, well, a little bit. I mean, I sort of was bringing in some influences from 2000 AD as well. People like Brendan McCarthy used to do these aliens and creatures and weird figures with bizarre shaped heads and stuff that have, like, you know, horns and things. So there's a little bit of that as well.
Oh, it's great. It's a really, really enjoyable read. I mean, despite being up against the clock with it, I would imagine that, you know, that you've still got, when you look back now, you can see there's an awful lot of fun in there, because I think it's a good fun story.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm very conscious when I'm drawing these things of trying to keep the pace up. So, you know, if there's dialogue scenes, I try to have people doing things while dialogue's going on. I try to have people move from A to B, perhaps, or, you know, just doing bits of business. It's sort of almost stagecraft in a way. It's the kind of thing that actors do when they have to deliver long monologues. They try to have something to do to make it visually interesting. So I'm always conscious of that side of things, I guess.
Yeah. Could you maybe tell us a wee bit about the process for when you've completed, you know, when you've completed a page? Would you send that off straight away, or would you wait until you've got everything completed and then send it off?
It depends on how tight the deadline is. Sometimes, I mean, ideally I want to finish the entire job and then send it off all at once so that I can go back and check for inconsistencies before the colorist gets his or her hand on it. If the deadline's really tight, sometimes you have to send them off in small batches. Obviously, that's a lot easier these days with being able to scan things and send them over the internet. When I first started out, it was physical artwork. So if you drew something and sent it off in small batches, that could be very expensive, and there was a much greater chance of things getting lost in the post, things like that. But these days it's a lot less hazardous, I suppose. And also you can cut it a little bit closer to the wire with deadlines too, because you don't have to worry about shipping things and the time that's going to take.
Well, that's definitely one of the good things about, you've pretty much always been a home worker anyway, I would imagine.
Pretty much, yeah. I had a little brief period with some other cartoonists in a studio in the early 90s, but I've mainly been working at home most of my career, yeah.
Yeah. So you've sent it off, and then do you get to see the colour when it's been added before it goes to print, or is that just sort of your job's done when you've completed the original?
Ideally, I like to see the colour. It's good to be able to have another set of eyes to check for mistakes and to make sure that what I've drawn is clear enough that the colourist didn't make any mistakes, you know. Again, it's a question of deadlines. Sometimes it's just got to go to the printers straight away, so that I might not see the colour before it's been sent off. But, you know, if the workflow is going as it should, then ideally, yes, I do get to see the colours before it's sent off.
Yeah, it's Paul McGann, you know, as a doctor in terms of when it coming to capturing his likeness. You know, you've got the likes of William Hartnell, who's got that beaky nose. Pertwee's got that bouffant hair. Tom Baker with his eyes and the hair. I mean, how difficult is it to sort of capture McGann in getting that likeness without it becoming too caricatured?
Yeah, the younger ones are always harder than the older ones because they've got fewer lines in their face, you know, fewer battle scars to latch onto. If I was doing McGann now, I think he'd be much easier because, you know, he's clearly an older man now and he's got a few more visible signs of aging that I can work with, which is, you know, it's just accentuating what was always there, I guess. You know, the shape of the face is still the same. It's just that he's got actual lines on his face pointing it out these days, whereas you sort of had to guess where they were going to end up when he was a younger man. But yeah, the older ones are always fun too. I seem to remember when I did Pertwee, it basically fell out of the pen the first time I drew him. It was, he was just so distinctive. And I guess also because he was my first doctor, so maybe I just thought about him more than I had the others.
I suppose that it was almost like a mental muscle memory as to how that face looks, because you've got in your mind. That does have a logic to it, yeah. So how do you look back on the whole Prisoners of Time thing? Obviously you had your tight deadline, but I think it's a great piece of work, a great, fun, enjoyable story, and it's just dynamic, and it feels like it's constantly on the move. It's got an energy to it.
I really appreciate that. I was hoping that came across. Yeah, great. That's what I want to hear. It's sort of, I guess, my style. It has that kind of directness to it as well, which probably accentuates that.
Quite happy with it, and you look at as you flick through those pages today.
Oh yeah, I was having a look earlier, and you know, to refresh my memory of what the story was about before our conversation, and I was pleasantly surprised that it stood up as well as it did. Yeah, no, it's always the way, isn't it? You hate the work as soon as you finish drawing it, and then you look at it a year later, and oh, that wasn't as bad as I thought it was.
That's, well, I love it. So thank you so much for your time today, and so much for creating a lovely, enjoyable little slice of 50th anniversary action.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Huge thanks to Roger, as well as Scott and David. Quite an international podcast there. We've got a New Zealander, plus a couple of Americans, an English girl, and a Scottish man. So yes, another of our international episodes. That's what we like. We're all in favour of this kind of thing, aren't we?
Oh, yes, we are.
Anyway, let's move on.
Indeed. Until tomorrow, when we'll be handing the episode over to you, our listeners, to find out your favourite Eighth Doctor Christmas story. I feel like we've done this before. This feels a bit deja vu-y, but hey-ho. I've been Rebecca Chapman.
And I've been Kenny Smith, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Otherwise, tomorrow. Bye.
Oh, yeah, tomorrow. Forgot about that. Yeah, we'll be back then. It's a good job we're not recording these back-to-back and stockpiling them, like doing three in one day. That would just be daft. Mm,
that would be so daft. Why would we ever do that?
No idea. Anyway, we'll be back tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye.